Hello, everyone. Thank you for choosing us. I didn't know that it was going to be a competition between all the different sessions. I only just figured that out this morning, so thank you. So my name is Sue Brake. I am a Kiwi recently arrived here from the New Zealand Super Fund. I'm now working for Willis Towers Watson as a consultant in the organisation effectiveness area. But my background is asset allocation and investment strategy at the New Zealand Super Fund, and prior to that, I was on the dark side. I was in investment banking, had quite a long career in currency and derivatives and bonds and capital markets, here in Australia included. So my two colleagues today, all three of us will speak and then do a Q&A. We have Mr. Andrew Fisher, who is the head of asset allocation for Sun Super, well known, I think, to most in this industry. Both of these are your fellows in terms of actuaries. I am not. I have a maths degree, so sometimes I can talk your language, but I do not. I am not an actuary. And we also have Sam Killimer, who is from the Future Fund. He is the director of the Portfolio Design and Quant team there. He has a team of quants that look at the portfolio from a quantitative perspective, and he'll talk a bit more about how the Future Fund think about decision-making when he gets his turn at the lectern. So I think the plan is that I'm going to talk for about 10 minutes on some of the Willis Towers Watson thinking on best practice governance. Then eeny, meeny, Andrew can speak for 5-8 minutes on Sun Super, and then Sam on Future Fund, and then we'll just do maybe 20 minutes at the end on Q&A. So on that, I will start this up. So nothing happened. Oh, here we go. So you will be aware that there's a correlation between investment governance and risk. It's a license to operate kind of issue where if you screw it up, you get the keys taken off you. So that's, I think, pretty well established. Most funds around the world that have been thoughtful enough to have a set of investment beliefs will have that as one of their beliefs, that governance is important. The position we take on it is that it not only leads to a better run fund that is more likely to achieve your objective, it also has a return component. And the way we look at it is that it's either a positive or a negative relative to a reference portfolio, which is the simplest possible portfolio you could put together to meet your objective. So the work that we've done in this area, and this is belief-based because it's very hard to come up with hard data on these sorts of things, but working in this space for the last 15 years or so, I'm certainly, you know, total believer in this, and we'll talk about the magnitude of it shortly. So this picture is one of my favourite pictures because it shows a couple of things. It shows the fact that the value creation and value destruction from either great governance or poor governance gets bigger the riskier the fund that you run. And it also shows the convention we have for rating funds. We've rated a number of funds now around the world, building up a database on this. We have a fairly robust tool for doing this. It combines some assessment of culture, assessment of leadership, and some pure governance questions to come up with an overall score for organisational effectiveness. And we give that a credit score, like a credit score from single C to triple A. And what I can tell you is that the triple A's are extremely rare. I think the last count, it's less than 8% of really large funds, 100 billion plus, and less than 3% of large funds. And even lower as the funds get smaller because they have less resources to invest in good governance. Triple B is what we would call investment grade. You, at triple B, you are on average, equaling the reference portfolio, i.e. you're not doing any harm, but you're not adding any value either with your governance. Typically, you're pretty thoughtful at BBB. You're kind of aware of these things. You just haven't done much about any of them. And again, it's belief-based. And then this particular distribution is not symmetric. The BBB and below is most funds. And there is a large number that are in the below investment grade category. Okay. So I keep saying that this is belief-based, but we really are not alone in this. The number of funds now that believe that there's value to be added from good governance as well as risk to be avoided is increasing. Most conferences we hold or that I speak at, we do the polling question of, do you believe there's a governance premium? How big is it? And it varies. Occasionally there'll be one person in the room who's a naysayer who'll say no such thing, but mostly it starts at about 30 and goes to 100 plus in terms of where people think this premium is. That's probably enough on that slide. So how big do we think it is? We put it between 50 and 150 from poor to great. So some people talk about good to great, around 100 basis points or less, and from poor to great. And we've triangulated how to get there, but I, you know, will stress again that this really is belief-based, because you can't run funds in parallel and say our database is not big enough to say you've got good governance, you don't have good governance, and here's the return. So it's very much anecdotal. Working with the funds that we do that do have good governance, they do have great returns, but that is not hard facts. So what does it cost? The reason this is popular with large funds is that obviously the larger the fund you run, 100 basis points per annum on average, if returns were a straight line, is obviously a huge prize. Very difficult to get 100 basis points in alpha. So there has been a lot of attention in this over the last 10 years, and the typical cost is 1 to 2 basis points, including some upheaval internally, because there's a lot of navel gazing and a lot of second guessing and a lot of, it feels good to be in those investment committees where everybody's collegiate and you all agree and you make the decisions and you tick the boxes and you move on, and to get an annoying consultant come in and say that's not good governance does, you know, create some wheel spinning for a period of time until processes are changed. It's often also associated with culture. I think most of the work that I've been doing in the last year or so has been around culture, as people understand the huge role that it plays in investment returns, and also the fact that it's not in the too hard basket. Increasingly there are ways in which you can positively influence culture, and again, more people are becoming believers and going down that path. So in terms of, rather than sort of go through the framework of how we measure all the things, which is a little bit dry, I thought I would put up a table instead of the kinds of things we see that typify a well-governed fund versus those that typify a value-destroying fund. And I use this slide a lot because most investment committees that I talk to will recognise at least some of the behaviours in this value destroying. So I've just separated them into the four models that we talk about when we talk about transformational change, but we'll kind of skip through them. So one of the first ones is the very top one on the list, mismatching skills. So this is the biggest issue that we see with a lot of funds in Australia. They're relatively small and they have a limited governance budget, but they have aspirations for a complex investment strategy. And so that mismatch between the skills that they have to run that and governance they have to run that kind of strategy and the strategy they're running is value destroying ultimately, because they don't have the resources they need to deal with that complexity premium. The other one that we see a lot is this blame game, where people focus on things going wrong and are looking for things going wrong, and then once something does go wrong, which it will go wrong, there's this finger-pointing sort of after-the-fact aspect to it rather than a pre-mortem approach where you've thought about what might go wrong and what you can do now to ensure that you're well prepared for that situation. The other one that's very common, and there's been a bit of research on this, is time-varying risk appetite. There's a large number now who have very well-stated risk tolerance or risk appetite statements that help them to sort of go, we knew this was going to happen and we decided that this was what we were going to do, let's stick to it. But we still see a large number of funds that, it's a human reaction to a bad environment, become fearful and want to close things down. And I think that is a large part of the cost, is that whipsawing that you get if your risk tolerance is not well articulated and stable. So there's a bit of a theme to what we thought we'd talk about with investment governance. Happy to take general questions about it, but we thought we'd talk about a total portfolio approach, or future fund, call it the one portfolio approach, and just talk a little bit about what that is. It is something that we have also adopted and advise clients to think about. And what it basically is it's ensuring that the process by which you build a portfolio is really conscious of your objective or your client's objective, your stakeholders' objectives, through all parts of the portfolio. So rather than it being a sequential process or hierarchical process of making some decisions and then allocating out to other specialists who then make the next decisions against some sort of benchmark in a relative performance way or a tracking error way. We believe that, and increasingly others, again, there's a growing number of funds who are going down this path. It allows, again, that governance premium in terms of making sure that all of the decisions are consistent with the objective of what you're trying to achieve. Everyone's very clear about what the risk in the portfolio are. We will acknowledge, though, that there are challenges in being able to run a total portfolio approach, because our industry is full of wonderful people who like working as an expert in an area and being able to get on with it. And in a total portfolio approach, you have to put the needs of the total portfolio ahead of the needs of the bit of the portfolio that you're running, and that's not always a human thing to do. So there are some interesting challenges around TPA, one portfolio approach, which we'll get to in the questions, I think. Two more slides. So this is just showing the Willis Towers Watson process. On the left is the sequential process that we had been following to set client portfolios. And there's this iteration between the two purple boxes where we try things out, put some good ideas in, run some filters over it, does that kind of work, and then pop out the bottom with the client portfolio. The approach now is much more to start with that bottom-up idea generation and ideas and assess them all under common metrics for how attractive they are in terms of meeting the portfolio objectives. Different funds have different ways of doing this. It's an interesting challenge, but it does require you to be more forgiving in terms of hard data. You need to be able to accept that what's important isn't necessarily what's easy to measure. So there is a very important role for confidence in all of these portfolio construction techniques. And then the last slide is just on these soft meshes. There's also a move that we think makes sense towards what we call portfolio quality. So instead of focusing on past returns, there's a dashboard that the governing bodies get that talk about the different attributes of a portfolio that make it the best portfolio for the particular objectives. We've divvied it up into some categories of what makes it attractive, but what this gives is an opportunity to have a really deep and meaningful strategic conversation with the governing body about what each of these attractive aspects of a portfolio are, what the right metric for them are. Where does that little RAG indicator go from green to amber? And that allows you to have a much more detailed conversation with the governing body about what risk is and what tolerance is. And increasingly we're seeing some of the best run funds working out their version of this. These are just some ideas from us. So at that point, I think I'll hand over to Andrew.
Would you like to stand up?
Yes. And talking to the mic, please.
Thank you, Sue. I don't know how to use this machine. Hang on. Let's try this. So I have the grand sum of A slide, which I'll put on the screen as a reference point. So Sun Super. So Sun Super, it's probably important to have some context around what Sun Super is as a fund to explain how we make investment decisions and why we perhaps don't use something like a total portfolio approach. Sun Super is an industry fund that is not actually an industry fund. We have union representation on our board. We're a profit for members fund, but we don't get any union flows into the fund. So every dollar in Sun Super, with some small exceptions, I mean, there's a couple of percent that the Australian Workers Union in Queensland sends to us, but realistically, we're not on the awards. We're listed on the awards, but we're not the default fund of choice on any awards. So what that means is every dollar that comes into Sun Super is a competed dollar. Most of the money in Sun Super has come from either small businesses in Queensland or corporate clients. So anyone who perhaps works at PwC, for example, PwC is one of the corporates that we manage on behalf of. So in that sort of environment where you are competing for money, investment returns and relative returns are fairly important. On top of that, I'm prepared to say that we didn't make the rules. I mean, we didn't decide that choice was important. We didn't decide that people could choose. We didn't decide that members should be making these decisions for themselves. That was pushed down to us by regulators in a choice-based environment. People make choices and they tend to make choices on relative returns. So given all of that, I've been at Sun Super since 2010. We are fairly shameless in our honesty around the fact that we are trying to generate the best relative returns that we can. So if you look even in our PDS since 2010, one of our investment objectives, at one point it was actually the primary objective for one of our options, is peer relative returns. I think when I first joined Sun Super, in our PDS the balanced option said, this option is designed for people who are investing for 7 years and are worried about how their superannuation performs relative to other funds. Like, literally, that was the primary objective of the option. Now, that's not what we're realistically trying to do, but that gives you a sense of how honest we are. From my perspective, head of asset allocation, I think that honesty is quite important, because if you don't have clarity of objective, you can set yourself up to fail. We have multiple investment objectives we're realistically trying to achieve, and we try and resolve that down into a clear single objective that will actually see us successful and see our stakeholders actually feel like we've been successful. What I've put up on the slide is how we actually make decisions. So there's sort of two elements to governance. One, I think, is setting your objectives accurately. Two is how you actually make decisions to try and go about achieving those objectives. So board level basically is where we set. So the trustee, for anyone familiar with regulation, SPS 530, that's the rules. That's the rules that we as a superannuation fund need to abide by. Under SPS 530, the board or the trustees must set investment objectives. They also, there's a range of different things that sort of go in there, but essentially they have to set investment objectives for every option. They have to design a strategy for each option. Now what we have done with our decision-making structure is to say, well, look, that doesn't mean that our investment committee is now redundant, because in some ways, if you decide your investment strategy is your SAA, then that makes your investment committee redundant. So we've designed we design our investment strategies as a set of investment constraints and resolving that objective. So resolving multiple objectives down to a single objective. In essence, what we are trying to do is add at least 0.5% of excess return against a multi-asset benchmark that reflects our expectation of the peer performance, or effectively that peer risk profile that we're competing in. So we offer 85% risk asset option, 70% risk asset option, 50 and 30. We look at those in a survey and we try and add value. So everybody within the Sun Super investment team is kind of working towards the same goal, adding value against that benchmark. In terms of how we make decisions then, so the investment committee sets up for us they set the SAA, so how much money goes into each asset class. My job is to essentially advise them on what that decision should be, and then they also delegate down active risk budgets and rules around each of the implementations, each of the asset classes. So the investment committee sets up for the equities team how many managers, external managers they need to use, what sort of country exposures they can take against benchmark, essentially a range of limits. Within all of those constraints, that team then has a job to do, which is deliver an outperformance target. They have a fee budget that they can spend. My job is to advise the investment committee on what all those parameters should be, and then put together a portfolio with the highest likelihood of achieving the objective, which is the excess performance. So what we do there is we think about how correlated are each of these active return streams going to be, how confident am I or my team that this team can actually deliver, and what we try to do is ensure that within each of those teams, the level of impact and risk that each team takes is not does not dominate the outcome. So we don't want the equities team to decide whether or not we collectively meet our objective. We want everybody to be having the same, impact, and that comes down to diversification. Then when it finally comes down to actually investing money is delegated down to each of the teams. So I've kind of put up all the different decision-making points in the structure here. The key one on the right is the investment recommendation committee. So there's layers. Those layers 1, 2, 3 really is the scale of the decision, but that is an internal investment team committee that makes investment decisions. We meet once a week. Some weeks we have nothing on the agenda. Most weeks there's at least one investment up, or at least a review of an investment decision that was made during the week at one of the lower level committees. To give you a guideline, anything under $50 million is IRC3. That means one manager outside of the team can approve it. IRC2, there's two set delegates for each asset class. They have to both approve something for it to happen. That's up to $200 million. Anything over $200 million goes to the full committee, which is the 8 senior members of the investment team, myself included. That's all I was going to say, and then I was just going to leave it to questions after that, because I'm fairly open to take any questions that anyone would like to ask. It was my request to put the no media thing on the door. I was hoping it would actually encourage more people, but it wasn't particularly successful on that. But happy and open to answer any questions anyone has. And I'm going to hand over to Sam.
I'll try and be pretty quick because we're running a bit.
Well, we aren't.
Can I talk for more than 5 minutes?
No.
Oops, there it goes. Okay, so as Sue said, I'm from the Future Fund, and wanted to give you a bit of an overview of firstly who we are, just so that we're all on the same page. Obviously, people know the Future Fund reasonably well now. So we're there to provision for unfunded superannuation liabilities, the main fund, the Future Fund. It's about $141 billion, and that's got a real return of 4 to 5% objective associated with it. A more recent fund we have is the Medical Research Future Fund, which is a nominal endowment there to provide for medical research over in perpetuity, and that's a cash plus 1.5 to 2. And we have a couple of other funds as well, which are cash plus based, so less exciting from our perspective. As Sue mentioned, we have what we call a one team, one purpose approach, which is the same as a whole of portfolio approach in name, and I'll get to exactly kind of how that works in the next slide. But in terms of our strategic pillars, we also believe that it's important to leverage our external partners or our managers. We're not allowed to invest money directly without a manager being involved. That's a legislative requirement. And so we believe that an important part of getting the best portfolio is identifying a small number of high-quality strategic partners that we want to work with to help us improve our approach to design mandates from scratch, to access new asset classes and strategies that may not be broadly available. We believe in being flexible, nimble, and opportunity-driven, which means that our investment approach, I think, is a largely bottom-up process. So let me take the next slide, which is a bit small, but essentially, if we look at the assessment of bottom-up opportunities, that's really where it all starts. So We do have sector teams, so teams of specialists across different asset classes who are going out and finding the best risk-adjusted opportunities purely in their opportunity set. And then they're bringing those opportunities to our investment committee, which is an internal body, in a, what we call a first screen process. So here's an idea, we've identified it, we think it has these broad risk-return characteristics, we think that the opportunity cost of doing this investment can be described as this set of liquid betas, and we believe we should go ahead and complete due diligence on this investment, and the investment committee decides whether or not that's a good idea. Part of being a bottom-up driven approach is that we have representation from all of the sectors in that investment committee, and I'm sure this is something that Sue will be interested in asking about, is in practice, does that make the body a bit cumbersome and make it difficult to reach decisions quickly and efficiently? And I think that is one of the challenges of our approach, is getting everybody to be focused on the total portfolio outcome when they are there also with another role, which is managing their own portfolio within the book. This level playing field concept sits between the bottom up and the top down, if you like, and that's really making sure that when the investment committee is considering an investment opportunity, it's comparing it on a like-for-like basis with, as best we can, with other investments and that are available in the portfolio, and that includes things that we already own as well. So important to assess both opportunities and the existing investments in the same framework, and that's kind of one of the things that my team helps with. You go through all of that bottom-up portfolio construction process, you don't necessarily end up with something that's sensible in aggregate. So we have a completion function, which is really about deciding what are the broad betas we think the portfolio should have for our mandate at any point in time, and then what is the difference between the best opportunities aggregated and that broad picture. And then that's where we have liquid markets and overlays that can help to bridge that gap. At the fund level, we also set a number of risk budgets, which come on the right-hand side here, relating to overall risk exposure, so broad equity beta and the major equity betas. We have a short-term liquidity risk policy, which is really about managing the risk of a sudden crash and how we can best utilise our liquidity efficiently across the portfolio. Portfolio flexibility framework, which ties into the level playing field that I was talking about. So coming up with an appropriate opportunity cost for an illiquid investment and assigning some rating to that so that it can be compared with other investments and you can see whether or not you think the prospective reward is sufficiently attractive for that investment. Portfolio flexibility is also something we measure not just at the asset level, but in aggregate, and we manage over time. And so it's one of the key risk budget decisions that our investment committee makes, and something that it can also change through time. There's a couple of other policies there, but I'm conscious that I'm kind of running out of time. So just a quick overview of the decision-making structure. So our investment committee is internal, which is different from a lot of funds, and the board does get involved in ratifying or confirming the decisions to make investments and divestments, but it's really the investment committee that is driving the key decisions. Then we have a number of committees which kind of go to our joined-up process that support this. So the manager review committee considers the detail of the investments for a specific manager once they've been through that first screen process I talked about. Asset review committee looks at specific assets rather than manager mandates in detail. And then the senior investment team is a collection of all of the senior members of all of the investment teams looking at all of the portfolios in a periodic review process. And that, I think, instills a sense of ownership and of involvement from all of those people in all of the portfolios, which sounds like a lot to kind of be across all of the time, but we think it's important to facilitating this joined up process, and it also allows more easily for people to then subsequently transfer between sector teams and use their skill sets in different areas, because you're already starting with a degree of familiarity with each of the underlying portfolios. That was probably... Well, I'll leave it. I was going to talk about organisational structure, but I don't think we really have time. And probably the only thing to highlight there is that we have taken the recent decision to create some deputy CIO roles that sit beneath the CIO, one looking after private markets and one looking after public markets, and that's just recognising the distinct nature of those opportunity sets. Public markets will be thinking about what is the most efficient way to achieve exposures through factors or through liquid markets, and private markets will be looking across property, infrastructure, private equity, private debt, to see what is the best risk-adjusted return opportunity, and that is, I think, being facilitated in recent times a lot better by this change, because in the past, with a sector team approach, but a one portfolio, one team, one portfolio philosophy, there is always the danger that you don't get that cross opportunity comparison. It's not as rich as it should be, and so this is some of the things we're trying to break down. So that's probably the only other thing I wanted to mention was some roles that have been created to help facilitate the interface between the top down and the bottom up. So we had, you know, there was always the danger in a traditional investment model that you have kind of the strategy team, which is giving a directive from on high, and then you have the teams that are just trying to beat benchmarks. And what we've tried to do is create some roles that help to facilitate the conversation between the bottom-up teams and the top-down view, and create some forums that help that happen. So we do have a lot of, in addition to the senior investment team meetings, we also have macro markets forums and a weekly meeting as well, where all of the investment team can get on the same page in terms of the macro view, and also can feed in bottom-up intelligence that they're seeing in their sector, which might inform the macro view itself. So often there'll be sort of canaries in the coal mine that kind of pop up in a private equity sector review, for example, that give you some inclination about what might be going on in the credit cycle or some risk to the macro that you may not be seeing yet in the top-down metrics. So bit of a whirlwind tour, but that's the broad way that we operate a one team, one portfolio approach.
Thank you. So I apologise. I thought we'd have lots and lots of time for questions. So I have a few questions because I'm very passionate about the stuff. I can't wait to talk to Andrew. But I think maybe I'll let you guys go first, given there was quite a bit there that we threw at you, just in case we run out of time. So please.
Yeah, I had a question, maybe more for Sam and Anthony. So in the investment game, sometimes things go wrong. Like, you might make areas think it's a really great investment and you get in there, like Sue talked about the blame game, but I suppose you don't really want to go there, but you just can't help but to get into an investment and it goes wrong. How do you sort of recover or deal with that sort of situation?
It's never easy. So I think the senior investment team function that I talked about is the way that those issues usually start to get aired. And people aren't necessarily have to be reasonably thick-skinned in those conversations. So you've got the whole senior investment team looking at your portfolio and giving you frank feedback about how they think it's going and what they think you should be reconsidering. And through that process, we've had a number of things removed from the portfolio, because that is an early warning indicator to the team that they should be thinking more seriously about something. I think if you have a sector, a pure sector team approach, there's probably more of a risk of holding on to your losses and kind of trying to ride them out and recover, whereas you, because everyone has a vested interest in the outcome, you know, everyone is, and I didn't mention this, but everyone's remunerated on a total portfolio outcome, which is one of the, I think, key ways to help align people to that approach, then everyone's interested in everyone's portfolio. And so you don't have a chance to, you know, there's no hiding from that. And that's the way we've managed to make it work.
Absolutely bad things happen. I think, and I can think of quite a few examples. I think the important thing, I think, is communication all the way through. So to give you an example, I'll talk about a good thing before a bad thing. So to give you an example, right now our hit rate across all those active strategies is pushing 85 to 90%. When we do attribution right now, it's actually hard to find the detractor at the fund level. Now, when I go and talk to the investment committee about that, the point I try and make to them is, look, everything we do because we think we're going to make money. We certainly don't think they're all going to make money at the same time. The performance that we have right now is not indicative of our expectations over the long term. So I think one of the really important things is communicating to stakeholders in advance what is realistic and what's expected, and don't take credit. Be careful not to take credit when you're being lucky, because then you'll be punished when you're unlucky. So we try and be really honest about what is luck and what is skill in what we do. Where things have gone really poorly, and to be honest, what happens? People get fired. I mean, people get paid plenty of good money to work in this part of the world, and if you do a bad job, you should expect to be fired, to be honest. We fire external managers. I've seen internal people at SunSuper be fired as well. Where it goes wrong is when it's a surprise. Like, when a bad investment comes as an absolute shock and a surprise, and no one saw it coming, typically what that means is the person in control of that investment or in control of that area hasn't communicated well when things started going wrong. So I think, like, I mean, if I go to sort of Sun Supers, we have like these values that we have as core values. Number one is trust. Number two is accountability. There's like five or six of them. Those are like the two foundational values, though. Those two in particular, trust people to do a good job and expect people to be accountable and be honest and upfront. Nice.
Yeah, so I come from the liability side of things. So as the appointed actuary, my focus on investment governance is how we actually monitor the investment function and ensure that it's actually delivering what we want. I'd be interested, so in part how we do that is we have various restrictions, you know, as Andrew was talking about, sector allocations and so forth. How does that sort of work with your one portfolio approach? You know, it feels as though it's much more difficult to actually assess how things are tracking.
That's a great question. I'll get you to answer that as well. But I think the key is in the establishing of those parameters and a clear foundation with investment beliefs. So one of my investment beliefs is if you have unnecessary constraints, you're not going to have the optimal portfolio because you're, you know, if you ask someone what's your liquidity constraint and they'll go, oh, just, you know, never run out of liquidity. You can always think of an event, you guys are actuaries, where you're going to run out of liquidity. So it's a matter of being really clear what the constraints are for and that they are truly needed and they are collectively owned. So the value in this total portfolio is not in how clever the machines are that calculate the metrics. It's in how rich the conversation is that you have between those that are establishing the constraints, whether they be liability related or risk appetite related, and the way that that's embedded in the portfolio. That really is a large part of the value. So it's that dialogue, I think.
Yeah, just to add to that, our sector teams are generally negotiating very flexible mandates with not a lot of traditional constraints. So trying to keep the opportunity set as broad as we can within the skill set of that manager. So that can make it, well, does make it much more difficult to assess whether or not they're doing a good job by a traditional metric. And the way around that, I think, is to look at things in through a few different lenses. So across, you know, absolute return, liquidity, the whether or not they've actually managed to successfully generate alpha relative to the risk that they held on average rather than some other mandate prescription. So it's more about trying to look at everything in an absolute sense as much as possible and then measuring the performance of the manager relative to the opportunity set that they had in practice.
I have a quick go. I've already set myself up to be some tough questions from Sue, so I might as well make it worse. If I put myself in your shoes, and that's it's kind of my job actually to put myself in your shoes. I mean, my stakeholders are trustees, none of which have significant investment background. We have a couple of investment specialists there, but these are not investment specialist people. These are whole of fund management people. If I put myself in your shoes, the risk for me, and I've seen this before and we've even done this before, is for me to go in there and tell you what you believe about investment and markets, and for me to go and tell you about what you should believe about how we should do our job. And invariably that will fail, because invariably the minute something goes wrong, then you're going to turn around saying, you know what, I didn't actually ever believe that and you just convinced me of it and say I was right all along. So what we do try and do is, in essence, we actually spend a lot of time with this, with our board and with our directors and with our investment committee, understand really how do they want us to invest money? How do they think investment should be done? There's lots of ways we can solve this problem. Delivering a solution that matches your expectations, I think is the most productive way forward. So that's another reason why I think we kind of go down this more peer aware, path, is if I'm in your shoes, you want to work out whether or not we're doing a good job. You know, I mean, you're going to look at us and think, well, like, these are smart people. They know what they're talking about. How am I going to assess if they're doing a good job? Well, there's a bunch of other smart people out there who also sound like they know what they're talking about. Why don't I compare them with them? It's not a particularly irrational thing to do. And please keep asking questions before Sue starts asking me questions.
This is actually for Sue, so you can rest. I'm retired now after the last half of my career was in funds management, but I use some of my spare time. I'm a director of two listed investment companies that are very lightly constrained mandates in Australian equities, but I'm also a director of a boutique fund manager that's an ethical investment manager that invests money for charities and religious institutions, so it's a very much more conservative approach to investment. And I just wondered how your approach to assessing investment governance takes those differences into account.
Yeah, very much so. So we have the bells and whistles tools that we use to assess governance, but, you know, I come from large asset owner, and I very much get accused of and am very much a large asset owner. So there is an alternative that we do for looking at smaller, lower governance budget organisations. And it uses the same factors, that we have 12 factors that define good governance, and they're well published out there. You'll find them, Clark Irwin, from some research back in 2007. And it hasn't changed. We still use the same ones. But it's much more qualitative. We'll, you know, interview everyone and understand how we do the desk-based as well, but often that's not where the answers are. It's much more about individual styles. Often it's lack of clarity about what exactly it is that you're trying to achieve. And so it's a bit of a mirror where we just kind of reflect that back using the framework of the 12 factors to say, you know, here are some things. And it sounds incredibly simple, but if you don't have an asset consultant who's, you know, brave enough to reflect that back to you and say, here's how you can improve, then who is? So, you know, and it's this human bias that we all have. We all want to feel part of something. No one wants to be the outsider that is the annoying person that says, well, hang on, what about this? And, you know, it's very culture and psychology related, a lot of the governance issues that we uncover. So there's some very simple IGF sort of reg related stuff, but what we deal on really is much more in high performing and how to make sure that the investment decisions really are the best for the objectives that you have.
Hi, I'm interested in your opinions about how investment governance starts to fail, where you'd slip below the BBB, you'd go into value destruction. Is it from people turnover typically that you see? Is it from people not following processes, just maybe some bad investment professionals? Where do you start to see destruction and poor performance from investment governance?
It's actually a really good question. It's made me realise that I hadn't thought about it in those terms. It's actually, investment governance is really hard to maintain. You get your coveted AAA or AA or the equivalent. It's actually, you have to work really hard to keep it. But it's rare for someone to drop below the BBB because once you're aware of what it is you should be doing, you'll generally do it. The ones that are kind of caught in that sub-investment grade world haven't been thoughtful enough or being prepared to be thoughtful enough, particularly when it becomes personal. I mean, that's that God's great joke on us that everyone else can see aspects of us that we can't see ourselves. So it's, you know, it's been brave enough and willing enough, and I got quoted in the media this week, you know, and this is true, if we can't convince the board chair that there's a need for change, then there is nothing that we can do. It's a very personal kind of thing. So the tumbling down is actually less, there's a little bit of drifting down, but not so much the tumbling down, because once you're aware of what good governance looks like, you know, you'll avoid those situations where you tumble. It's much more people caught in that lower governance without even realising that they have, weak governance. Yeah.
I'll just a very quick one because I think we're getting wound up here. But having people change the rules on you repeatedly—that's so. I mean, I sort of live in a world where our board turns over fairly regularly by design. So having boards turn over, having the rules change, having the goalposts reset—that's to me is the recipe for poor governance. If I look back, the worst times in our governance, it's been when that's been happening.
Did you?
I would just add that the biggest challenge to governance will be when the markets are challenging. So everything seems to be working fine, but you'll really know whether or not you have a good governance in those times of turbulence.
Yeah, I always think a good one is if you have a stress test, and then stress test again. Yeah. That's how we calibrate our stress tests, because you don't get to stop running stress tests after the stress event. And I think that's where a lot of case studies end up in books, actually. So yeah, we survived the stress, but then we got shut down.
That's terrific. Thank you very much. I'm very pleased with those questions. So I didn't get my opportunity to compare total portfolio approach and relative aware and peer aware. So thank you very much. We've got some small gifts for our two speakers. They get chocolate. I think they're going to share it with me too, which is very good. So, yeah, thank you.